Since legalization in 2018, the cannabis industry in Alberta has been growing rapidly. Today we're going to look at its implications through two different lenses. John Carl with the Alberta Cannabis Council will talk about the industry perspective, and Dr. Sunil Rajput of Alberta Innovates will talk with us about two programs he's leading to address urgent knowledge gaps related to cannabis use. So sit back, enjoy. It'll be a hoot. Welcome to Shift.
Welcome to Shift. I'm your co-host, John Hagen.
And I'm Katie Dean. On today's episode of Shift, we are talking to Dr. Sunil Rajput with our health innovation team here at Alberta Innovates and John Carl, the executive director of the Alberta Cannabis Council. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So cannabis has been legalized since 2018, but it remains a touchy subject. But one of the things that we do best here at Alberta Innovates is that we take risks. And I think that when we talk about innovation, that's what innovation really means. It's taking risks, trying new things, failing, trying again, and perhaps succeeding. And so, Sunil, I know that we have a new program that was launched last fall, the M Cannabis Program, and that was a really big risk for you and for the health team and for Alberta Innovates. And I really want to dive into that, but I want to first hear from John about what the Alberta Cannabis Council is.
More than happy to do that. First, thanks for having me here on Shift. I appreciate the work that you guys are doing, and you know, I just love the idea of innovation across Alberta. So good on you guys for what you're working on.
Thank you.
The Alberta Cannabis Council was started with the goal of creating a unified voice for the legal cannabis industry to engage with all levels of government, as well as the AGLC, and really to bring the legalized cannabis industry together so that they can address the issues and the challenges that we see as legalization is developing. Nobody has the perfect model for legalization. I would like to say that I think Alberta has one of the better models, but nobody's got it perfect. There's changes that need to happen, tweaks that need to happen, and the Alberta Cannabis Council is the voice for approximately one quarter of the cannabis industry in Alberta at this point, and growing. To bring a voice to government and to the AGLC on those issues and those subjects.
So how have you seen the response from policymakers change over the last couple of years?
That's a really interesting question. I think that it's a near impossible one to answer, though. And the reason for that is that in Alberta, cannabis was legalized with the NDP in office. And shortly thereafter, the UCP took over. So there was a dramatic shift in policy and interpretation of policy just simply because of the change of government.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So, but since the UCP have taken over, I think that we can say that there's certainly a lot of educating that needs to happen with government because they didn't go through the process of legalization with the federal government. And I think John touched on this initially, there's a lot of uncertainty or lack of understanding of the legalization of cannabis. And a lot of people get their information from Hollywood, and Cheech and Chong are not a great representation.
They're not.
No, they're not. They're funny, they're entertaining, but they don't represent what cannabis is and what it does as a product. So we have to educate. That's our biggest challenge right now.
So what do you do there at the Alberta Cannabis Council? You're the executive director, but what does that mean?
Well, right now, because we are such a new organization, it means I do everything from sweeping the floors to the IT work, to engaging with government, to membership development, to adding members. If it gets done by the ACC, it gets done by me. I run an extremely lean organization where we don't have a lot of expenses and infrastructure because we're funded exclusively and completely by the membership fees of the members. There are no grants available to us. There's no additional money for us. This is purely an industry-driven organization.
Now, John, you said of the membership
out of all of the businesses out there and the industry, did I hear you say 25% are members?
If you look at the approximately 450 retail stores in Alberta, our members collectively represent approximately 100 to 120 of those stores. So we've got roughly, we consider to be a quarter of the industry working together in order to have this united voice. Since we're the licensed producers, but what's really interesting is that our membership has a third classification of members, and we call those our affiliates. These are companies that are not directly tied to the cannabis industry. They don't grow, they don't process, and they don't sell. And yet they want to see the cannabis industry thrive. We have insurance companies, construction companies, we've got lawyers, we've got supply companies. There's a massive number of people in Alberta who are employed through the benefit of the cannabis industry that maybe that might not have the word cannabis on their business card. And we need to bring light to that as well.
That's really interesting. I like to hear when communities come together and are working towards a common goal, even for though sure. that their memberships are really, really diverse. Can we dig in a little bit to the economics of cannabis? So I was reading a stat that said the domestic cannabis industry contributes $8.65 billion to our economy. So what is Alberta's cannabis economy doing, and do you see it changing in light of COVID?
Well, I think that, and we don't have any real hard numbers to work with yet, but I think COVID was actually a bit of a blessing for retailers. Not that it was really a blessing for anyone, but a lot of people were feeling a lot of anxiety through the COVID period. The isolation that people were feeling led them to seek ways to relax. And and a lot of people choose cannabis as their method of relaxation. A lot of people said, hey, I don't have to drive to work for the next 3 months. I might try this stuff. You know, I don't have to worry about the stigma that's attached to it. So, yeah, I'm going to try it this weekend, or I'm going to try it tonight. And I think that my guess would be that we actually saw an increase of sales during COVID.
I'll jump in and say that. So what John is saying, I second that from some of the companies that I'm working with who are actually tracking retail sales, and they have noticed a spike since we've gone into lockdown around early or mid-March. And so there has been a spike both in Canada and in the United States in terms of sales. And there's certain tracking software where they're looking at specific products, and they're one company has reported back to me saying that individuals are selecting higher THC type products as one class to help them with anxiety, overall mental health during this uncertain time and the challenges that lie ahead.
So you mentioned stigma, John, and that's really interesting to me because we have legalized it. It's been around, but there still is so much stigma around the use of cannabis. And do you think that plays a large part in policy and in how our government is handling, this sector?
I think it plays a massive, massive role in how many of our elected officials and government employees are dealing with the cannabis file. Absolutely. It's probably the biggest challenge that we're seeing as an organization is that, first off, a lot of these people don't use cannabis or won't admit to it. There is still, we refer to it as reefer madness. People are scared of it. They think it's an illegal drug that, will do harm to them. And if you look at the chemical impact of cannabis on your body, it's actually, it has less of a lingering or a detrimental effect on your body than that glass of wine you had with dinner on Saturday night or the six-pack of beer that you crushed during the hockey game. That is far more damaging to your system than cannabis. The sugar that you put in your coffee this morning has a stronger chemical effect on your body. Cannabis by itself is a fairly benign product to consume. The problem that we've had in the last 40 to 80 years of cannabis consumption is the additives, the fertilizers, and the other chemicals that they lace into the product in the illegal black market. That can be amazingly harmful to your body. And the legalization has been such a benefit for people who want to consume a safe product. The challenge we have is getting the elected officials to understand the difference between the two, to embrace the legal and to oppose the black market. You know, as an example, here in Alberta, between the two major centers, how many police officers do you think there are that are dedicated to tracking down and putting an end to the illegal black market cannabis trade?
I don't even have a guess. I wouldn't even know.
Would you believe two? There's two police officers in the province really? Whose job it is to take down the illegal black market.
Oh, wow. Okay.
They're both in Edmonton.
Okay. Oh, my goodness.
So it needs to be taken seriously. People think it's been legalized, so now it's all legal, but it's not. There's still a very, very strong illegal black market industry that's operating in Alberta that has gotten very, very bold. They're very confident that they're going to be left alone. People aren't ratting out their neighbors anymore for smoking weed on their deck because, you know, it's legal now, so they don't know if they're getting it legally or not. Mm. And quite frankly, the black market product is so much less expensive because they don't pay the 24% excise tax. They don't have the business licensing fees. They don't have to deal with the Health Canada paperwork and the fees associated with that. They're able to deliver where legal retailers are not allowed to deliver product. You can have alcohol delivered, but you can't have cannabis delivered. And legal retailers aren't even allowed to take orders online. So you can't buy your cannabis, pay for it, and go pick it up in the store. All you can do is reserve it and go and pay for it in the store. So black market has such an advantage in terms of their distribution abilities. And those are the sorts of things that we really need to address in this province if we're going to actually defeat this black market.
That's interesting, because one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, and I think you've just answered it there, but what are some of the issues your membership are identifying? But before we go into that maybe in some more detail, I just wanted to be somewhat of a counterpoint to your comments about, the additives not being in there and it being safer perhaps than alcohol. And I just want to, you know, with alcohol, there's things like fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. I'm not sure, you know, pregnant women imbibing. I'm not sure if there's been any research on, cannabis use with pregnant women. So I think that still is kind of out there as something that needs to be researched. I don't know, Sunil, if you're aware of anything.
So it's very little. The research on cannabis due to prohibition has been very low. However, since the early 2000s, there's been an exponential increase in scientific papers. So there's very strong scientific interest in exploring cannabis, but due to prohibition, it was really very hard to do the work. There was no funding for it. Materials were not available. But since the early 2000s, when there was a more relaxation of the regulations, that's when the research started to advance. And likewise on the clinical trials as well. So there's a rise in the global clinical trials as well. So there is still a lot of knowledge gaps and what we don't understand about cannabis. And cannabis itself is very complex. It's like over 560 chemicals that are contained within the plants. We don't really understand in terms of how those chemicals work together. Mm-hmm. Also, there's gender differences. Males and females respond differently. So there's a
variety. Well, I've heard stories of there's a difference in the way that people of different racial backgrounds are responding
yes,
to it.
Yes, yes, yes. So all of that is all very important in terms of trying to understand. And so once we get into this, that's what Alberta Innovates is trying to do, is trying to bridge those knowledge gaps. That's what we're working on. But it's not just like any other substance. It's there's a variety of factors that come into play in terms of the harms, right? Like even water can be a harm if you inhale it, right? So it's taken the wrong way, right? So we have to be mindful of both the risks and the benefits of a particular substance. And cannabis is the world's most consumed psychoactive substance. It's about 4% of the world that is consumed cannabis in 2017. That's about 188 million, roughly. It's very widely used, but there's a long history of anecdotal evidence. And so that's where, since you have anecdotal evidence, it's very mixed. Some work, some don't work, and it's not really been robustly interrogated through science.
Yeah, and Johnny, you touched on something important there. I don't think anyone is advocating for pregnant women to consume cannabis. I don't think anyone advocates for pregnant women to consume anything that isn't First Health Canada approved specifically for pregnant women. So I just want to make it clear that we're not advocating for that.
Of course, yeah, I didn't mean to imply that, but you know, I think it's, you know, we should dive a little more into the M Cannabis work that Sunil, the project that you're doing, because again, like this is a drug that's been around for a long time, and it's now a nascent industry. We've it's legalized. It's been, you know, 2 or 3 years now, and your point, Sunil, about the research, the work that we're doing to support that research, I'd love to dive into that a little more.
I'll connect just our last bit of discussion and what Katie mentioned at the top in terms of looking at that this is a touchy subject, and we have to be very mindful of de-risking as a government agency. If we're putting out the first medical cannabis research and innovation program in Alberta and out of Alberta Innovates, we need to be very, very mindful of how we're actually going to approach and share this out with the community. So one of the questions that I had through my long list of stakeholder engagement before we even launched the first M Cannabis program, which I'll talk about in a minute or two, I asked the question, what of all my stakeholders, what is the most public perception challenge that you are facing, and how are you mitigating against it? And so the overwhelming theme that came out of that question is it really depends on whether or not you're talking about recreational use or if you're talking about medical use. So that's the dichotomy to think about. But it's still the same product. It's just the purpose, right? Needs to be clear. What are you using it for? So with that, we started off with launching the first program. It's the M Cannabis program. It's the long name is Exploring Cannabis-Based Medicines and Tools Program. And I'll just help orient you very quickly. When you think of any drug development process, it needs to first go through a bunch of preclinical studies. So this is before it even gets to the human. So this would be in cells. This would be in animal models like fish, mice, or rats. And then it gets to a clinical trial. And that's where humans are involved. And once it meets safety and efficacy requirements, so meaning that it works and it has very few or little harms, then it can go to a regulatory body for approval to say, okay, now we can then release it to a broader population, but we will still continue to monitor safety and efficacy. And so that's the post-market world or the real world setting once the drug has been approved by a regulatory body. So that's just typically how the drug development process works. But with cannabis being so complex with the number of chemicals that are contained within the plant, the so little research that has been done so far, we needed to figure out a way, like, where do we actually start with cannabis? So what we did is the first iteration of cannabis, of the cannabis program, is the M Cannabis, is rooted in preclinical. And so it's now looking at the chemicals that are in cannabis for pain specifically. And so you might ask, why pain? Well, in our survey, we found that pain, 1 in 5 Canadians are inflicted by chronic pain. So that's 20%. And the economic burden in Canada right now is approximately $50 to $60 billion annually in both indirect and direct costs. And we have an opioid crisis going on. So that opioids have their place in pain management, but if it's misused or overused, it can lead to other concerns like addiction or harms. And so we were looking at cannabis as an alternative for pain control, for pain management.
Ah.
Right. So it's a $1.5 million program. We have 5 senior level rock star scientists in Alberta that represent University of Alberta, University of Calgary, University of Lethbridge, that have been awarded to address or study cannabis for different facets of pain.
Okay. So I know we can't like dive really deep into these funding calls specifically because there are 7 of them and we only have a limited amount of time. But do you have like a favorite or like one that you're really intrigued by that you could talk to or tell our listeners about?
Okay.
Is that asking who your favorite kid is?
they're all very wonderful and what they're doing and they're all approaching in different ways. But if I can just maybe touch on one, and I'll route it to a recent conversation I had with a patient. So I'll start with the patient first. So the patient is a young woman, and she said that, you know, I had to get some oral surgery done. It was very debilitating in terms of the surgery that had to take place, and I had immense amount of pain, and I needed to support myself, so I needed to go back to work. And she didn't want her physician said, "Well, we have opioids you can use for treating pain." And she said, "Well, you know, I tried that. It was giving me various different side effects that I didn't want." And in the end, she chose a cannabis product, and she told me that the cannabis product helped to alleviate her pain and had low cognitive impacts. And that was important for her because then she can drive to work. She can get her work done or be productive at work, you know, in her healing stages, and then return back home. So that's in the patient example that we're trying to work for, trying to understand what we can do to fill those knowledge gaps so those patients can then have access to the best science or the evidence to support a particular product. So the example is that there's Dr. Jason Dyke at the University of Alberta. He is examining, looking at cannabis products that have low cognitive impact. So that's what he's investigating. And he's looking at the full spectrum of cannabis products, not just a single chemical like THC or CBD, which most people are very familiar with. These are the two major cannabinoids, but I just put in context that there's actually 220 plus cannabinoids, and most people are referring to only 2. Wow. Whereas Jason at the U of A is looking at the full spectrum that's coming off the cannabis plant, and then trying to find something that or a product that has low cognitive impact. So relating it back to the patient, that's what the patient is looking for.
So like when you talk about this like low cognitive impact, and then she was driving to work and I was like, what, Sunil? No. But it's interesting to know that you know, there are other chemicals that are in cannabis that won't have the impact or the effects that we're used to seeing in the media.
Exactly. So typically what we're might hear in media is around the euphoric highly psychoactive properties that come from tetrahydrocannabinol or THC. But there's other chemicals that have much lower psychoactive properties, and so they don't have the same type of euphoric properties that THC have. And so it's now understanding how those particular chemicals work, either alone or in combination, to deliver pain relief and also have the less psychoactive properties that, or those euphoric properties that the THC exhibits.
So basically, what the message here, though, is if people are experiencing pain or they want to explore cannabis as a therapeutic, they should talk to their doctor about, rather than going out and experimenting.
Or right.
Some experimentation is okay, but don't go driving and stuff like that.
So this is, you touched on an interesting thing. So they'll go to their physician to get some advice on this, but physicians will refer to their guidelines in terms of what should we do. And the mm-hmm. guidelines are very limited right now because the scientific evidence is very limited.
Of course, right.
So mm-hmm. physicians who want to support their patients as best as they can refer to the clinical guidelines, but there's so many clinical gaps that they don't know how to best support patients who are demanding other therapeutics that are available on the market. And so that's the challenge. That's where the new cannabis program that we're working on, that's where that we're trying to address that side as well.
Pause there. I want to talk about the future of the M cannabis program. But first, what you said, Sunil, was really interesting to me, how, you know, our physicians want to help our patients, but they're following these guidelines. So John, question to you, are you working with physicians and the medical board to change these policies or guidelines?
Well, we the Alberta Cannabis Council really does focus on the retail and therefore recreational side of cannabis. However, we have been hearing that there is an awful lot of red tape involved in the medical side, particularly. It's challenging for doctors who don't need to prescribe massive amounts of cannabis to a patient, but just, go smoke one joint a week or, have a gummy every once in a while. But the follow-up and paperwork that they're required to do, even for that small of a suggestion, is disproportionate to what they're actually suggesting to their patients. So, I remember years ago, my doctor said to me to eat healthier and maybe have a glass of red wine with dinner to calm some nerves. And he didn't have to follow up on that. It was no big deal. Mm-hmm. But if he were to today say and pop a gummy instead of having a glass of red wine, he'd have to follow up with me every 2 weeks and do a ton of paperwork for that recommendation. So there needs to be some modernizing, I guess, maybe of the restrictions or the processes. But as far as engaging with the medical side, we feel that that's not really an area that we're particularly equipped or prepared for, to put it bluntly.
So I want to touch on this anecdotal evidence that we kind of spoke to a little while ago. So, you hear on the news these so inspiring stories about these children who have had seizures for years and, a little bit of CBD has completely cured them from this. Or, you hear about all these stories, but, Sunil, you pointed to the fact that we don't have a lot of information. There's not a lot of work being put into really understanding this. So how are you guys, taking this anecdotal evidence into consideration when you are, researching and funding programs? Or are you?
Short answer is we're not, because anecdotal evidence is clinicians don't use anecdotal evidence. They need robust scientific evidence to make an informed decision, because they're weighing the benefits and the risks of treating a patient using a particular intervention. I just want to go back a little bit with the clinical guidelines. They are evolving. So, you know, the United Kingdom is the most advanced right now in terms of having the most recent 2019 clinical guidelines around cannabis use. And so there is evolution that's happening in the clinical space. And so, but in order for guidelines to change, robust scientific evidence needs to help inform that. So what we're doing is, as I mentioned earlier about the drug development process, is we're addressing studies or supporting studies, Alberta Innovates is supporting studies in the preclinical domain. And now, we'll get into in the post-market or real-world domain as well to support our understanding of how effective is cannabis use.
Is there any work that's being done? Well, obviously, there's some work being done here because we've got John and you, Sunil, talking in the same space. But how is industry collaborating with medical research? Let's start with you, Sunil.
So that's an excellent question. I've been an industry scientist for the past 13 years. I've come from our InnoTech side of the house. And so when I first was working on developing a cannabis research and innovation program, I went to industry first. And I went to try to see, is there some common challenges that we can address? And what I found in those early conversations is that, yes, there's some common challenges, but industry didn't really want to play together yet. And this was back in 2019. And fast forward to today, and what I'm finding is some of the licensed producers are still of that sense, particularly the medium to large enterprise. However, the small companies are more keen to work together in some sort of consortium. And also the other data-related cannabis industries are willing to participate. In fact, the new program that we're working on right now, as part of a unique feature of that program, is a strengthening panel in which I do have industry members in there who will then be interacting with researchers to perhaps form a collaboration and work together. So industry has been front of mind in terms of understanding the needs that industry has in terms of the challenges, and research needs to coincide with that as well.
Now, John, is there any idea why they're bigger producers maybe a little reluctant to participate?
Well, first off, I got to say, Sunil, that was a very thorough and awesome answer. Thanks for leaving me with basically nothing to say. I appreciate it.
Just ditto.
Yeah. What I will say is I think a lot of the producers just have so much on their plate right now in terms of getting businesses up and running. And these aren't small operations. These are big businesses. And all of their attention and all of their efforts and all of their resources are going into getting production lines up and running, getting product to market. Like these are still startups, even if they are multi-billion-dollar companies in some cases. So I think we'll see more appetite from industry to work with researchers in the future. But right now, they're just trying to get going. They're not really looking at that kind of a relationship yet. And I think yet is the important word.
That's a really good point, John, because I think we need to remind ourselves, as I said earlier, the industry, it's nascent. This is 3 years old now. I know there was work that predates this, of course, but you know, they are startups, as you've indicated. So it's something hopefully on the horizon, eh?
Well, yeah, and I'd love to see that collaboration in the future. I think there's a spectacular opportunity to learn. And as Sunil said, there's so much about these plants that we don't know. There's so much potential in them. We have no idea what problems this plant is going to solve, and we have no idea what problems it could potentially cause. The more research that can be done, the more we can get out in front of both of those points of view.
For me, I love economics, and I love hearing about what is going on in our province in terms of startups and entrepreneurs. And the point you just made, John, about how you know, these businesses are still in their startup phase, right? Mm. And we know that. And I had just looked at this stat last week. The BDC, the Business Development Bank Account. What is it, John? BDC? They small to medium sized enterprises. So that's enterprises under 500 employees. Canadians are employed, 89% of Canadians are employed by SMEs. And so with this industry worth, you know, $8 billion, there's so much potential for employment and just a boost in our economy through this cannabis industry. So I'm really glad to hear from Sunil that we are investing in the science and research of that, because I think that as this progresses, this will be a major part of our economy.
It has that potential for sure.
Absolutely.
So Sunil, let's move on to M Cannabis 2.0.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's talk about that. What are you working on?
Okay. So this is super exciting as well. So this is about the real world. And so it's evaluating cannabis medicines in the real world. And so what that means is now we're outside of the controlled clinical research trials. So since we have legalized cannabis, now it's like, okay, what can we learn from cannabis use? So this is as examples of real world data is like electronic medical records, insurance claims, billing activities, patient registries, social media, even the mobile devices or your app that you have on your wrist, like if you wear an Apple Watch and you're collecting health data. That's all examples of real world data. And so I know cannabis companies are collecting what is the genetic background of someone versus and the outcomes of cannabis use. So there's a company collecting that kind of data. There's a leader in Canada known as Strainprint, and they collect patient reported outcomes. So a patient goes and buys a particular cannabis product, and then they log into their app and they say, okay, we bought a certain product. This is my pain score at the beginning. And then the app pings you and says, okay, well, this time, how are you feeling? And then you give a rating in terms of has it decreased, increased, stayed the same? And it helps the patient understand, okay, is this helping me or not helping me? And then they can also log into a community of other users and say, what's helpful for you? I have this particular condition. What's helpful for you? So now what we're trying to do is bring those different data assets together and say, okay, now let's answer a major policy or clinical question. And as an example of a major clinical question is how effective is cannabis use versus opioid use? Or is there a change of using cannabis and hospital visits? Like, do we see an increase of hospital visits or a decrease in hospital visits with the use of cannabis? Those are the type of broader health clinical questions and that can be addressed. And so we're working with the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Alberta, a variety of different industry partners that are bringing their data assets in as well, and other researchers and clinicians in the province of Alberta. And so a unique feature, as I alluded to earlier, is that there'll be a strengthening panel. So applicants who are successful in the first expression of interest phase, they will have an opportunity to pitch their idea to this unique strengthening panel for an opportunity to get some feedback on the problem, get some feedback on the methods, feedback on the data sets, and an opportunity to collaborate. So really to bring this together so that academics who have never seen these unique industry data sets might have an opportunity to push the envelope in terms of understand cannabis use. And then there would be a chance that if there's a collaborative opportunity, go to a full proposal, and then you can go on in the competition.
Well, that's exciting, Sunil. That sounds really cool. When does M Cannabis 2.0 launch?
So the target date is early September. So my plan is towards the end of next week is the goal. And so it's coming up very soon. These are projects that will have budgets up to 300 K for up to 24 months. So these are fairly substantial projects that can come forward. But we think this is a very unique opportunity to bring forward industry, academics to work together to understand cannabis use.
So you mentioned data, Sunil, and I know from a previous episode of Shift, shameless plug here, but it was an episode we did with the Alberta Data Institute and Mark Diener. And from that episode, we learned that data is a really, really tricky, subject, especially in terms of digital health. So are you working with the Alberta Data Institute and are you tackling these issues of data ownership a little bit or is there anything going on there?
Absolutely. So two parts to your question. One, Mark Diener, the director of the Alberta Data Institute, is part of the strengthening panel. He's been helpful in terms of influencing what sort of data considerations we need to make in terms, for example, how do we describe the data? So everyone's data assets is highly valuable. So we're not asking anyone to put their data out there for public use, because that's their bread and butter. That's how they're surviving. But we need a consistent way that's informative to describe the data. So that means, so it's a description of what do you have. And so it's typically called metadata. So what do you have? And that information needs to be sufficient enough so that researchers have some insight in terms of what is actually in the database. It's a description of the database. So that we are learning from Mark in terms of how to describe that. And then the second piece that you asked in terms of the challenges around the data agreements and some of, we'll leave those type of agreements between the data custodians who own the data or who have all the control over the data.
So like a patient? That's like a patient?
Yeah, it could be a patient. It could be a company. Could be the college. That is an arrangement that will be made with the researchers specifically. So they need to come to the appropriate agreement so that data can be aggregated, can be de-anonymized, and shared for research purpose.
Cool. That's great. So lots going down with the M-Cannabis 2.0.
Yes.
John, now what's next on your plate for the Alberta Cannabis Council? What are you guys working on now?
Well, I think we don't have anything nearly as exciting as that. I mean, you're going to change the world with what you're doing. There's something like awesome. What we're trying to do right now is we just want a fair playing field for the licensed producers and retailers inside of the Alberta economy. We really do believe that we've only touched the beginning of what this industry will do in Alberta.
I think you're right.
That $1 billion figure. It's interesting because we know that the legal cannabis industry is about 20 to 25% of the whole market. The black market's carrying somewhere between 75 and 80%. So if $8 billion represents 25%, it wouldn't be unimaginable to say that this is a $30 billion industry. What we need to do, though, is we need to get government to support the growth of that industry. As Albertans are losing jobs, as Albertans are uncertain about their future, as the oil and natural resource industry is not able to carry the jobs that it once did, we have a phenomenal opportunity here to create good paying, stable, long-term legal jobs for the residents of, or for the citizens of Alberta. Let's be honest, that's exciting stuff for us.
John, you mentioned some interesting points. So I just wanted to tie in with what you said earlier about that the ACC is not currently working with the colleges in terms of addressing the physician knowledge gaps. But maybe I'll propose something to you here, is that with the competition between the illicit market and the legal market, one, you can compete on price. But the other, you can compete on quality of product and reassurance of the product. So in the legal market, just like when you can buy alcohol from a legal market, okay, you can trust that product, that the, whatever percentage is on there, it's met to code, and it's, you can trust buying that particular product. And I've heard from patients and even citizens that they would trust a legal product because of the quality standard. So my proposition is that to bolster up the profile of licensed producers and try to move away from the illicit market, is that there might be a need to try to have consistent research materials. Maybe these producers can produce some material that they're all producing a particular strain that has some sort of consistent chemical profile, and then that starts going towards research opportunities. And because I think one of the challenges is going to be is if everyone's producing different cannabis plants, different chemical profiles, researchers are trying to get their hands on materials and they're trying to test something, it might become a mixed bag in terms of, okay, we got some effects here, we didn't get some effects here. So we need some standardized materials that we can all test. And if there's industry support in terms of bringing together some set of cannabis materials that researchers can then all access from a pool of researcher of licensed producers, that might be supportive in terms of bringing in more support for the legal market and supporting the clinical gap. So this is a round way of describing it to you, but I was thinking as this could be a proposition.
Wow.
Did we just witness the birth of a potential partnership?
Well, I think you may have, Sunil. It's an exciting opportunity. I know that other groups have tried to form a cross alliance between industry and research, but I'm not against the idea of having that conversation and seeing what we can do. I think you and I actually met once back in December to talk about this. It's certainly not off the table for me. It would just require actual industry members rather than a professional association to get involved. But I'm happy to work with you on trying to put that together.
You guys are awesome. What an amazing chat.
Yeah, this is fun. I didn't come here thinking that this was going to come up, but I think it's a wonderful idea.
John, well, Sunil. I said we had a great time chatting and listening to both perspectives, learning about what's going on with the move into clinical research from real world applications and industry stance and how you guys are, you know, working to support the industry. I think it's great. It's eye-opening, and the potential for this to become something huge is there, but to become something huge in a safe, clinically tested sort of way is it's there's so many opportunities here.
Yeah. Thank you. I just want to add one thing. I think John C would share a view on this, just in terms of the future outlook of where we're both going in terms of representing Alberta Innovates and John representing the ACC, is that Canada, as you all well know, is leading the charge in terms of legalizing cannabis amongst the G7. But we're home to some of the biggest cannabis producers here in Canada, and we have a very strong research community here in Canada. So we have an opportunity to raise the bar here from Alberta, from Canada, to support Team Canada and be on the world stage in terms of putting out or addressing knowledge gaps in the clinical and the policy space, and having industry provide thrust in terms of identifying the needs and help to orient the best direction. So I think John can agree with me on this, that we have an very strong opportunity and well positioned to become global leaders here.
Absolutely. The industry, whether it be recreational or medical, is in its infancy. It's going to be so much larger than it is now. And if Alberta is truly looking for diversification of its economy, if we're truly looking to create really good, long-term, stable jobs in this province, here's a fantastic opportunity. And if anyone from government is listening to this podcast, I challenge them to reach out to us and let's create those opportunities for Albertans. I'd rather see it happen in Alberta than somewhere else, but it will happen.
Yeah, I agree.
Awesome. Yep. Thank you guys so much. Sunil, this is so motivating.
Thank you very much.
What you do with this podcast is fantastic, and we really appreciate it.
Thanks, John. Anytime.
Shift is brought to you by Alberta Innovates. We can be found online at shift.albertainnovates.ca, or you can email us any old time at shift@albertainnovates.ca. On behalf of everyone here, I'm John Hagen. We'll see you next time.